From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 125, Fisherman's Terminal. Upon the formation of the Port of Seattle in 1911, the commissioners immediately got to work on developing a comprehensive plan for port infrastructure, which would ultimately be submitted to the voters for approval. On the south side of Salmon Bay, which was then a saltwater inlet of Puget Sound that stretched between Ballard on the north and Magnolia Interbay in Queen Anne on the south, they selected a site for a cargo handling dock, which they included in their initial concept. They also regarded the terminal as an opportunity to generate support for the Lake Washington Ship Canal, which was then being built from Salmon Bay to Lake Washington. Its early construction is of particular significance because it will help to assuage the fears of lumber manufacturers on the bay about the impact of the Lake Washington Canal construction on their operations. With the assurance of a deep-sea dock at their doorstep and a convenient canal running out to the Sound, it would appear that even the most skeptical of people must be persuaded of the tremendous potential that the section of the city holds. The commissioners wanted to construct a dock and cargo facilities for ocean-going ships on the west side of the proposed port in order to serve trade and feed the United States Army's Fort Lawton, which was located immediately west of the terminal near Magnolia. As these designs were being prepared, Miller Freeman, the publisher of Pacific Fisherman magazine and a longtime advocate for fisheries concerns, suggested that the port include a snug harbor for fishing vessels in Salmon Bay, which was eventually implemented. Later stories would credit the Puget Sound Purslane Fishermen's Association with being an early backer of that concept as well. At the time, fishing vessels did not have a permanent home port on Puget Sound, and they moored up wherever they could find moorage during the winter months. Some were forced to park their boats on beaches, which was a less than ideal condition that made it impossible to prepare the boats for the upcoming season. The suggested site's proximity to the city provided access to transportation infrastructure, labor, and supplies, and its potential for mooring a large number of vessels would allow fishermen to pool resources and lower prices as a result of the shared resources. Additionally, Seattle would benefit because vessel owners would spend money on repairs, maintenance, and supplies in the city before traveling out to fisheries in Puget Sound, along the West Coast, and in Alaska as a result of this arrangement. The fishing fleet brought in a lot of money to the city of Seattle. Among the goods going through Seattle's harbor in 1913 was 600,000 cases of salmon and over $25 million worth of fish products, according to a report from the time. Frozen and fresh halibut, dried herring, salt cod, whale fertilizer and oil, bottom fish, shellfish, pickled herring, salted salmon, halibut fletches, also known as cheeks, black cod, salmon bellies, smoked and deviled fish, candlefish, flounder, smelt, redfish, codfish tongues, roe, caviar, baitfish, and seaweed were among the products passing through. The port commissioners agreed with Freeman's concept and began making plans for a fishing vessel terminal on Salmon Bay, which they initially dubbed Fisherman's Headquarters. The position would be even more advantageous once the Lake Washington Ship Canal locks were finished at the bay's mouth, as the saltwater inlet would then be transformed into a freshwater reservoir. In addition to eliminating tides in the terminal's boat basin and lowering maintenance expenses, this would also help to extend the life of wooden fishing vessels. When the port's comprehensive plan was approved by voters in March of 1912, work on bringing it to fulfillment began almost immediately. In June of 1912, condemnation proceedings were initiated against shoreline parcels owned by the Oregon-Washington Railroad and Navigation Company, the Farmers Loan and Trust Company, the Seattle Cedar Lumber Manufacturing Company, the City of Seattle, and King County, among several other parties. The port sold land it had on Smith Cove for additional land on Salmon Bay owned by the Great Northern Railway, increasing the overall terminal area to 45 acres in early 1913. While it would be necessary to travel through a narrow, 3-foot-deep channel through the tide flats until the construction of locks at the outlet of Salmon Bay was completed in 1916 to gain access to the new terminal at low tide, the port began construction of the fishing and cargo terminal in February of 1913. After the locks were completed, it was necessary to fill a large portion of the land that would be utilized for onshore facilities in order to raise it above the level at which Salmon Bay would rise. In order to accomplish this, a bulkhead was built across the site with dredging waste from the boat basin being stored behind the wall. In the end, it was discovered that the fill material appeared to be relatively strong and stable, but after being churned up by the suction dredges and mixed with water, it looked to be a thin paste and separated from the water with tremendous difficulty. Aside from that, the water-laden fill was causing the bulkhead to become out of square. Work had to be suspended until the water was evacuated and better sources of fill material were obtained. The dredge spoils from the ship canal excavation were used to complete the project. Construction of the overwater facilities continued in the meanwhile. The commissioners intended to construct one pier for fishing boats on the east side of the terminal and three piers for cargo on the west side. They intended to build a net warehouse adjacent to the fishing pier with lockers available for rent by vessel owners. In order to pull vessels out for maintenance and repairs, marineways, which are ramp-like structures used to transfer vessels between the water and the top of the pier, would be built between piers 2 and 3. A big wharf on the west side of the harbor, along with a massive storage shed, would give ample area for freight handling. As soon as the bay was elevated by the locks and larger ships could access the port, the 1,000-foot slip adjacent to it would provide berthing capacity for ocean-going boats to dock. There were spur tracks leading out to each of the cargo handling piers from the main lines of the Great Northern and Northern Pacific Railroads that ran near to the facility. There was also a cold storage structure for fish on early plans for the terminal, as was a car ferry slip, which was meant for transferring rail cars across Salmon Bay to industrial locations on the north side, but was never actually constructed. On the 10th of January 1914, the Fisherman's Terminal was officially opened. A mooring system, a two-story warehouse for nets and fishing gear, 24 storage rooms, offices, a locker room, a fisherman's headquarters, and the marine ways were all included in the initial construction of the terminal complex. Even though a massive dock on the west side of the terminal was built to accommodate cargo, it was only ever utilized as an overflow holding area for the Port Smith Cove terminals, which are located south of Salmon Bay at the extreme end of Interbay. Rail links to the piers do not appear to have been constructed. Instead, the Great Northern Bridge, located west of the locks, and the Northern Pacific Bridge, located east of 14th Avenue Northwest, served as alternate routes for transporting train cars across the waterway. The arrival of the terminal was hailed with great enthusiasm by the owners of fishing vessels in Puget Sound. A parade of over 200 boats formed in Puget Sound, including participants from Tacoma, Everett, Bellingham, Anacortes, Olympia, and other ports on the Sound, as well as delegates from Alaska. "Wake up, Tacoma," read a sign held by the Oregonian as they marched down the street. "Please provide us with cover for our fishing fleet." The march proceeded through the locks and arrived at the terminal in time for the day's events to begin. At the dedication ceremony, Frank J. Heeman gave a message from Hiram Chittenden, the president of the Port Commission, who had played a key role in the planning of the ship canal earlier in the year. Specifically, Chittenden praised the terminal's ability to organize and solidify the scattered fishing industry of the Northwest to provide a home for the extensive fishing fleet and to provide such assistance as the port rightfully may be able to provide in protecting the fishermen and marketing his hard-earned product. A former state politician and businessman from Tacoma, Peter David, talked on the fishing industry in the Northwest. Governor Ernest Lister, Seattle Mayor George Cotterill, Port of Seattle commissioners, and others spoke at the event and shared their perspectives. In an adjacent warehouse, a banquet for over 2,000 people was held, with entertainment provided by the United Norwegian Singers. The fishing fleet home port in Salmon Bay attracted a lot of attention very early on. Approximately 50 boats were scheduled to overwinter at the dock in 1913, according to a report by the commission. Several years later, in an open letter to the Federal Trade Commission, the Port Commission boasted of its ability to accommodate 250 purse seiners and other fishing vessels, as well as gillnetters, trawlers, cannery tenders, and other vessels. By 1917, 226 vessels were anchored at the terminal, putting the facility on the verge of meeting its aim. Other tenants were drawn to the development as well. The Queen City Yacht Club leased a clubhouse near the Ballard Bridge that had been built by the port, but the club would be forced out of the area by encroaching industrial uses within a few years. In addition to the Meacham and Babcock Shipbuilding Corporation, which owned a shipyard at the station to build Ferris-type wooden steamships for the Emergency Fleet Corporation during the First World War, there were a number of other new industries formed at the facility. Their boatyard was capable of building up to 6 ships at a time and was a hive of activity throughout the facility. Adrian Estep and Fred Kimball leased space from the port near the marine ways on the east side of the terminal and established Estep and Kimball, a machine shop that employed 5 men in fishing vessel maintenance and repairs. The port had considered leasing land to a boilermaker company, but instead decided to keep the area and utilize it as a storage warehouse in the hopes of attracting an Asian shipping company that would take advantage of the train connections that were near to the terminal. Over the next couple of decades, in addition to the on-site marine companies, neighboring coastal areas would be populated by firms associated with the marine industry. Machine shops, engine repair shops, shipyards, sailmakers, and other enterprises took advantage of the aggregation of several hundred vessels in the terminal's moorage to expand their operations and grow their profits. The first full overwintering of the fishing fleet at Fisherman's Terminal took place during the winter of 1917-1918. A reporter for the Seattle Times waxed poetic about the harbor and the variety of vessels moored in the docks, writing, "Two more fishing vessels came into the Forest of Masts as the Port Commission's large Salmon Bay port today. They were sea-worn and stained, and their rigging and gear had been patched and repaired after being battered by the North Pacific's wild sprays. A forest of masts erupts on the decks of abandoned vessels such as Nea Bay trawlers, daring halibut schooners, a black-holed and ancient barge, Alaska steam whalers, an Arctic whaler famous in the far north's annals, sturdy cannery tenders, idle passenger steamboats, spick-and-span yachts, dilapidated craft of all rigs and makes, vessels of all colors." After that, the report noted how quickly the facility was growing in popularity as a tourist destination, with more than 150 people stopping by to see the vessels on a recent Sunday. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, the terminal was somewhat strained financially. The location originally occupied by the Meacham and Babcock shipyard had been occupied by a number of tenants, the latest of whom was the Pacific Wood Products Company, which went into receivership in 1930 after having been in business for more than a century. Due to deterioration of the piers, at least two ships, the Nehalem and the Gedney, sank while moored and were not removed from the water by their respective owners. In 1937, the port considered detonating explosives beneath the surface of the water to destroy them, but due to the fact that they had not been formally abandoned, they were allowed to remain in situ. Improvements to the terminal were made possible by a combination of approximately $15,000 in port funding and over $100,000 from the Federal Works Progress Administration, which was completed in late 1934. Workers reconstructed the bulkhead, cleaned up the big marine ways, and performed a number of other minor enhancements. Because resources and people were redirected to the war effort during the Second World War, upgrades to public works were curtailed across the country, but one notable project was accomplished at the terminal. In 1944, George Treadwell, then assistant chief engineer and eventually longtime chief engineer at the port, built a new form of pier to replace four of the previous mooring piers. Treadwell went on to become the port's top engineer for the rest of his career. They were known as sawtooth piers because they had slanted slips with little pieces sticking out from the main pier, much like the teeth of a saw. Most of the way down their length, the vessels overlapped each other, and the tooth offered access to each vessel from its bow. Once the work was complete, sometime in 1945, it was possible to moor four times the number of vessels previously possible. In addition, the port constructed two new net and gear locker facilities to replace a shed that was destroyed by fire in 1942. In 1948, King County voters approved a $1 million bond measure to expand the facility in response to the expansion of the North Pacific fisheries. These projects were only a prelude to a new phase of Fisherman's Terminal operations. The terminal was planned, first and foremost, to be the finest commercial fishing station in the nation, and second, to be an exceptional tourist attraction showcasing one of Seattle's most important sectors, according to a Seattle Times article. Improved access, enlarged facilities, and the installation of facilities for both fishermen and visitors were all part of the project's objectives. Port authorities referred to Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco as a model for their efforts on numerous occasions in newspaper stories and other media. The first phase of the project to be finished made it significantly easier to travel to and from the terminal by car. By 15th Avenue Northwest to Fisherman's Terminal, the Port of Seattle, the City of Seattle, and the Northern Pacific Railway all made contributions to the construction of the Emerson Street Viaduct. A dedication ceremony for the viaduct took place in August of 1950 during Seafair Week. Seafair Princess Carmela cut a portion of fishing net using a fishing knife instead of the more conventional ribbon and proclaimed, "I give my blessing to all the fishermen in Ballard. Hopefully this viaduct brings them good fortune." The Port of Seattle purchased an additional 20 acres along the west side of the terminal to make space for storage facilities. The west wall was built to sustain firm ground along the western edge of the moorage basin, allowing it to be used more effectively. The four sawtooth piers that were completed in 1945 were supplemented by two new 625-foot ones. As part of its expansion plans, the port constructed two net sheds measuring 60 by 100 feet, made minor infrastructural improvements, and dredged the slips to handle larger vessels. The administration building, which was constructed along the south side of the piers, served as the project's focal point. It housed nautical enterprises, port offices, a restaurant, coffee shop, and a tavern. The Valhalla Room of the Wharf Restaurant, as well as the Moby Dick Tap Room, were both decorated with murals depicting marine life by local artist Jack Corsaw. The paintings, according to a Marine Digest supplement published in conjunction with the terminal's grand reopening, were created using a novel media, photographic transparency dyes blended with oil colors on glass. All of the restaurants were owned and operated by John Barrows, a well-known Seattle businessman who formerly owned Barrows Restaurant and worked as the vice president of food operations for the Bartell Drug Company. The restaurant and coffee shop had a great view of the moorings, making them excellent places to people watch and observe the vessels. The extra piers increased the port's capacity to approximately 1,000 vessels, and by 1952, when the project was completed, 568 boats were moored at the terminal in October, with the port expecting the number to reach 600 by the following spring. Businesses such as the Seattle Boat Exchange, Fisheries Supply Company, Flagler's Commercial Boat Sales, Wakefield Fisheries Company, and the Consolidated Net and Twine Company were among those that set up shop in the new administration building to serve those vessels. In addition to the fishing vessel owners Marineways, Harris Electric, and Seattle Ship Supply that already occupied space in other terminal buildings, they joined a growing list of enterprises that had already established themselves. The State Department of Fisheries relocated its headquarters to newly acquired land on the west side of the port, near the intersection of 20th Avenue and Thurman Street in 1954. The agency formerly had a location in downtown Seattle's Smith Tower, but thought it would be more convenient to be closer to the vessels that its workers used to police the area's waterways, as well as the fishermen with whom they collaborated. Its temporary reprieve would be brief, however, because the state Supreme Court declared shortly after that all state agencies were required to have their headquarters located in Olympia. After vacating its tiny wood frame headquarters in 1963, the Department of Fisheries moved to a larger facility down in the Capitol. Following that, in 1968, when the Port of Seattle made extensive modifications to the terminal in order to make it more appealing to travelers, the terminal underwent its next major transformation. The entrance to the Wharf Restaurant was upgraded as part of a beautification project, which also included the addition of a 120-space parking lot and the improvement of landscaping around the facility. Not long after that project was complete, changes in the fishing sector began to take place. A decrease in the number of smaller vessels used in salmon fisheries in the North Pacific and Puget Sound coincided with the beginning of the beautification project. It was in 1976 that Congress passed the Fishery Conservation and Management Act, also known as the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which extended American control over fisheries management to waters within 200 miles of the shoreline and encouraged the development of much larger groundfish catcher processor vessels to fish deeper water. At the same time, the thriving king crab fishing resulted in the introduction of larger boats into service. It was impossible for the new vessels, which ranged in length from 100 to 300 feet, to fit into the slips on the sawtooth piers. A growing amount of non-marine construction along the ship canal made it increasingly difficult to find moorage outside of the terminal. Because of these developments, the Port of Seattle embarked on a new expansion project that began in 1986. A new pier was constructed at the northern end of the west wall, which extends over the north side of the moorage basin to the south. This dock could accommodate the enormous factory trawlers and catcher processors that operate out of the terminal. In addition, the Port of Seattle established a facility for factory trawlers at Terminal 91, which was at Smith Cove. The expansion and rehabilitation project involved the construction of a new office building to replace the existing administration building. Owners of fishing vessels and other users of the terminal were concerned that renovation might result in the yuppification of the facility. Building design and signage were inspired by the industrial style of the neighboring structures in order to minimize this possibility. Chinook's, which is owned and run by Anthony's Restaurants, took over for the Wharf Restaurant. In the southeast corner of the terminal, a new net shed with a floor area of 20,000 square feet had been constructed. Seattle Fishermen's Memorial Committee was established in order to raise finances and construct the Fishermen's Memorial. In 1986, the committee held a design competition to select an artist from among the applicants. Ron Petty was awarded the prize for his concept for a bronze sculpture depicting a fisherman hauling in a catch, which would be mounted on a column and surrounded by bronze fish and crustaceans. The names of fishermen and crew members who have perished at sea since 1900 are listed on plaques installed on concrete memorials. As a gathering place for the community to memorialize those who have passed away, the memorial has served that purpose admirably. The names of recently lost crew members, as well as the names of crewmen who have lately gone missing, are added on a regular basis by the committee. The expanded moorings for larger vessels were promptly taken up, and the new facility was seamlessly integrated into the regular operations of the terminal. By 1991, the terminal had served 775 vessels of various sizes ranging from 75 to 300 feet in length. Despite the effectiveness of such adaptation, changes in the fishing sector persisted throughout the 1990s, having an impact on how fishing vessel owners used the port. In response to higher restrictions on commercial fishing, more vessels shifted to the groundfish fishery, and salmon fishing vessels consolidated in response to tighter restrictions on commercial fishing. As a result, fewer small fishing boats required moorage, and the number of available slips at the terminal increased. By 2001, the terminal had a 31% occupancy rate, prompting the Port Commission to consider allowing recreational boats to dock at the facility. Some fishing vessel owners were concerned that this regulatory change was part of a bigger trend in Seattle that jeopardized industrial locations despite the fact that pleasure boats had previously been anchored there. Because of changes in zoning and the creeping in of non-industrial uses through variances and other exceptions to the regulations, there had been a rise in the demand for waterfront area as well as an increase in the price of that land. Furthermore, the incursion of non-industrial users had frequently resulted in complaints about noise and truck traffic in other parts of the city, which further restricted the ability of industrial users to operate. Among those who spoke out against yachts were Pete Knutson, captain of the Gillnetter F.V. Loki, and an anthropology instructor at Seattle Central Community College. He advocated at public meetings for the preservation of Fisherman's Terminal's industrial character in order to prevent the eventual erosion of the economies of scale provided by the community of crews, vessel owners, and related industries that had grown up around the facility. Knutson took the most forceful stance, while others raised concerns about the need for protections to protect the fishing sector if pleasure boats were allowed on the water. Regardless of whether or not pleasure ships were permitted to moor at the terminal, port officials stated that the current occupancy rate could not be sustained. For the facility to remain self-sufficient, moorage prices would have to be raised in order to meet operating expenditures. That burden would rest on the shoulders of the vessel owners, which could result in an increase in the vacancy rate. During the implementation of the new shared moorage policy in 2002, it became possible for pleasure boats to fill berths alongside fishing boats, with the caveat that fishing vessels were given first priority and commercial uses were considered to be the principal purpose of the terminal. Despite concerns that this strategy would result in the displacement of small fishing vessels, 15 years after its implementation, small fishing vessels continue to constitute the majority of vessels docked at the port. An economic impact analysis completed in 2017 estimated that the seafood products harvested by vessels fishing the waters spanning from Oregon to the North Pacific and returning to the freshwater moorage offered by the Lake Washington Ship Canal System were worth $545 million. A total of approximately 500 of these vessels were berthed at Fisherman's Terminal during the off-seasons. In addition to tugs, workboats, and other commercial vessels, the terminal is also home to a number of small cruise ships. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Seattle Times, the Port of Seattle website, NorwegianAmerican.com, the Magnolia Historical Society, HistoryLink.org, the Seattle Room at the Seattle Public Library, and SeattleRefine.com. Thank you for listening to episode 125, Fisherman's Terminal. Episode 126 will be released next week. A special thanks goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Hull. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing still a Guamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.